goodmorningcomrade.com. Jeff here today. We have a very special guest. We have David Starr. David is a professional wrestler, independent wrestler. He's also an organizer with We the Independent. He also, I didn't realize that you had a podcast until we talked last on Union Thoughts. But David, how you doing, man?
I'm doing good. I guess as good as you can be, you know.
Welcome back to where real freedom
everything
is.
Everything kind of does. Freedom. Yeah, I just came back to America.
Yeah, you spent several years kind of on and off in the UK, huh?
Yeah, I was there since September of team, and now I just had to come back here basically due to the pandemic because you know, the UK government is kind of dicking around with who they're giving unemployment to or who they're to, or essentially across the board in and it goes for here too, because I've now had to apply for unemployment in America because the UK denied me because I was on there on a work visa, not on a residential visa. Some crazy thing like that.
Get out of here.
So now, so now in the US, I'm dealing with another US government. You know, Boris Johnson's doing terrible there, doing terrible here, and you have all this crazy this whole thing is a massive failure of government, but I'm bunked up with my mom now and yeah. As moms do, my mom probably more than I need to. being of the background that we're bearing, but it's okay. It comes from a place of love, so I understand.
Yeah, I first I think we talked about this last time on Union Thoughts, but I first heard of you when I saw you at Joey Janela's Spring Break 2, and you wrestled Mike Quackenbush in that show. That was such a great show, top to bottom. A gel match stood out from the sort of like technical standpoint. That was a lot of fun, but that one also that was also the show that an invisible wrestler won a battle royal sort of thing. So that was the kind of night, and it ended up we sang Bon Jovi song with the great Sasuke. It was a hell of a night on a hell of a weekend.
What a roller coaster ride you just described! It is a great time. It was pretty awesome, and it was definitely a dream to wrestle Mike Quackenbush. That was super cool. I would love to do it again. I feel that I've gotten so much better over the past couple of years. What a great time. The spring break shows are always sick.
Yeah.
They're always sick. WrestleMania ended up getting kind of canceled this year because of everything that we're going through.
You know, that's an interesting sort of thing I guess we could sort of drill down on. Because the way, I suppose, they did have a WrestleMania, but like the indie mania weekend that happened prior. Kind of like set the stage here. So in 2018, I think it was, or it was 2018, WWE, the wrestling company, had their biggest show of the year, WrestleMania, in New Orleans. And they do every year when that happens, they have independent shows that are just all over the place that entire weekend. And it's just shows that are not affiliated with this company, but there's just it's like a Wrestle Fever weekend for all of these different things. And that had like the fact that there was no real WrestleMania weekend didn't happen at all. And that's just such a strange, you know, so that had to be really awful for a lot of workers and a lot of, you know, like independent wrestlers and promoters and all the things. That's money you count on coming in.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think that this idea of the independent wrestling scene following WrestleMania, because you have to think of, I mean, the show itself is going to draw, you know, I mean, if you talk about what it did in Texas Stadium, or it's not Texas Stadium, whatever the Dallas Cowboys show is.
Yeah.
Their stadium is called. It drew like I think over 100,000 people. And then you had, then you get like the small WrestleManias are like 65,000. So you end up getting total traffic of wrestling fans. It does get around that 100,000 people range. So then you have a bunch of indie companies that kind of follow the crowd and they run their own, like you're talking about, their own indie shows, and they kind of pair up together. They get like all-star people who basically aren't signed to WWE that you can see in matches that are just far superior. Yeah. And when I say that, I mean it because there's not really as many restrictions and everyone's just kind of going balls to the wall and everyone's just trying to put on the best possible show for the crowd. It is just such a more intimate and, I mean, it's just a better experience in my opinion. But that's been happening pretty much as long as I've been. I think the first WrestleCon, and someone's out there can correct me if I'm wrong, I believe it was 2000 in Miami, I think, or maybe 2011 in Miami, something like that. It was around then, the year this has been happening, and so many indie wrestlers at this point depend on this massive weekend where you're getting, you know, I've wrestled up to 9 shows on WrestleMania weekend, like where I'm just going from place to place to place to place within whatever New Orleans or Orlando or like Brooklyn and New York and stuff. Well, no matter where it is, you're bouncing around and you're just getting all these shows. You're getting all and you're in front of the biggest audiences a lot of times that you'll wrestle in front of all year. And you're selling so much merchandise. And now that kind of got just taken out from underneath a bunch of independent wrestlers. And then WWE still kind of had WrestleMania.
Yeah.
But they did it in an empty arena. They did an empty arena WrestleMania. Like, can you imagine all of these people that have done, like, they've lived their whole lives to wrestle on that massive platform. And
nobody's
they do it
there.
In front of nobody.
Oh, like, my someone God. Like Drew,
yeah. Someone like Drew McIntyre, who won the WWE title against Brock Lesnar in the main event of WrestleMania, did it in front of zero people. Yeah. And like, and he's such a good dude, and he's such a good wrestler, and he's had such a great journey.
Oh my God, his story in the business is amazing.
He's had such a great story, and he's so humble, and he's such a nice dude. And then his ultimate thing of overcoming the best combat sports athlete of all time in Brock Lesnar in the main event of WrestleMania is in front of zero people.
Yeah.
The same thing horrible. As Raw the next day or SmackDown the day after that. It's like, oh,
why
God,
are you doing
a,
this?
What a tragedy.
Yeah. Why are you even like having the show, you know? I don't know. Like,
yeah, I mean, everyone kind of wants them to shut down.
Uh-huh.
Like, as far as fans, like, fans aren't into these empty arena shows. There was a WWE worker who anonymously came and said, and no one feels safe working these shows, even if they're having testing and doing all that. There's no need to have these shows. WWE has plenty of content to air. They don't need to subject their workers to this unsafe environment. And for those of your listeners that don't know, WWE pro wrestling, if there's ever been an example of why there needs to be an equal seat at the table from labor, it's in professional wrestling and WWE specifically. Like,
no kidding.
It pretty much highlights every single labor issue that's ever existed in any industry.
Yeah,
is pretty much when it comes to workers and WWE.
Yeah, worker safety is a huge one. Worker out of pocket travel expenses, healthcare, just straight up pay. You know, all of that merchandise that, especially in WWE, like they get a fraction of what they're selling with their face and their name and their brand or whatever on it. You know, it's all just being like just falling into the pockets of the McMahon, you know, cartel.
In straight up, like all that stuff, if you were talking about WWE specifically, typically, this is the stat I love to throw out because it gets people going like, what are you kidding me? If you look at professional sports across the board, like all over the world, on average, the average athlete, pro sports union, they will get 50%. Revenue is pretty much split between management and athletes when it comes to sports. It's about 50-50. In WWE, the athletes get 10%.
Whew.
So from a cash flow standpoint, it's offensive. Mm-hmm. And then you're talking about merchandising. I just recently had a conversation with a huge, huge player in the main event scene, WWE, for a couple of years, Ryback. Mm-hmm. He was telling me on his own platform when we had the interview that he would sell 8x10s. He'd sit there, have to come to the arena early and sign a bunch of 8x10s at these meet and greets, mm-hmm. which he loved to do. He loved to talk to the fans and stuff like that. But the pictures they were being sold for like $20 a picture. And he was seeing 83 cents per picture sold.
Oh my God.
Those pictures at the volume they purchased, you're talking like 25 cents, 10 cents a picture.
Yeah.
Somewhere in that really low range.
Right.
And he's getting 83 cents.
Yeah.
Per picture.
It's all IP is what it is. It's all intellectual property and branding and copyrights and all these other things.
You know, they don't get these wrestlers for WWE. They don't get royalties on their likeness being used on the WWE subscription network. They don't get royalties for their likeness being used on YouTube, which generates tens of millions of dollars for WWE every single year. They don't have pension plans. They don't get health insurance. People on the main roster have to pay for their own travel up front and own accommodation up front, except they have this thing where it's called, colloquially, it's called the Golden Circle, where there are these wrestlers that are taken care of, where they mm-hmm. get their travel paid for, they get their accommodation paid for, they get a better percentage of their merch, but they only do that for a select few amount of people.
They're the made
men.
And
it makes everybody happy. Yes. And they're obviously the people that are the most powerful mm-hmm. in the industry. So they're basically being bribed.
Yeah.
And then they have this other thing called a Legends contract,
mm-hmm.
which essentially is the pension plan that WWE does.
Yeah,
so
the closest thing.
When you're done, you might watch WWE or you watch pro wrestling, and mm-hmm. you end up seeing like certain old timers like show up.
Mm-hmm.
Like certain people get that.
Yeah, heavy hitters and the ones that didn't piss off the boss.
Exactly. So it's this way of keeping everybody in line. Mm-hmm. It's a way of keeping everybody in line. WWE has really done a evil genius job of dividing a workforce, of union busting 101. That's really, Vince McMahon has perfected union busting.
The gold standard of union busting.
He is. I mean, even Jeff Bezos isn't getting away with it now. I just heard what 60 Minutes just had a story on about how Amazon's screwing over workers.
Yeah.
I mean, it was still a little too friendly to Amazon, itself, but still something,
mm-hmm.
which I mean, that gets talked about when mm-hmm. it comes to one of the billionaires in America.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And to bring it back to like the product now too, like the what's going on, these empty arena shows, you were mentioning that like fans hate it. It's because it's not like part of like wrestling itself is sort of like a dialogue between the audience and the people in the ring, right? They're like that's a key component in the entire show, is the fact that like, you know, they do this, you know, super cool thing or something that, you know, people can sing along to or whatever, and everybody goes crazy. Like that's the whole experience.
Yeah. 100%. And it's like the problem is it's not an indictment of the performers, you know.
No,
like,
of course not.
That's one of the things that I think that's one of the things that people get upset about. Even some of my friends work at these corporate wrestling companies. When if I'm on Twitter and I criticize the business practices of these companies, sometimes I'll hear it from my places, because wrestlers have had this idea of loyalty and gratitude just beaten into them. And
from day one of training,
because I'm criticizing, it really is. It's one of those things, dude, humbleness, all that stuff just gets beaten into you where you are just supposed to be so gracious for somebody giving you the chance to wrestle on a show. Some like, it is pretty wild. If you just reframe that and you go, the chance for you to, you know, lessen your life expectancy and put your body on the line for somebody else to make money off of you.
Correct.
All right. Well, but whatever. Yeah. I digress. So these empty arena shows, they're not bad because the performers aren't trying their best or killing it. It is just like you're saying, it is such a spectator sport. It is such an experience with an audience. And I've watched a few of these clips from these empty arena shows, whether it's from AEW or it's from Impact or
whatever.
All these companies that are still trying, all these corporate wrestling companies that are doing empty, the wrestlers are still kind of like playing to the audience as if there's an audience there that's outside of the camera.
Yeah.
Which is, it's awkward.
Yeah.
And
how can you not?
And ratings are bad for it. It's just weird, man. Yeah. Like, there's been showing ratings are going down, and there's also a fear that there are these people that are, you know, tuning into wrestling for the first time because there isn't really sports that's out there that are going on.
Yeah.
So they're like, oh, okay, well, wrestling's on. Let's watch wrestling. And they see these empty arena shows, and they're turned off.
Yeah.
Because it sucks.
Well, yeah.
And it's not the performer's fault.
Yeah.
It's just the circumstances.
And like, part of the even, like, the watching it on TV experience, like, you can tell, like, something is a good match or a bad match if you've never seen wrestling before, if, like, the crowd is just, like, freaking out, you know? Like, that's how you can tell if the story is being told and all the stuff's happened.
So that's kind of the other thing is, like, things that I've learned is that based on what I've seen, just my own evidence of, like polling an audience, what they think are good matches, what you think are bad matches, and you kind of realize people that aren't wrestlers judge what's a good match and a bad match completely different. And now that the audience is completely taken away, and like you're saying, it's not there to influence whether or not you like a match or you don't. If you're not a pure wrestling fan, you're not gonna like an empty arena match. Like the weird drama stuff that's added, like the I like to say, like, amongst my peers, if we're talking about it and we do something that's just very pro wrestling,
there's sometimes
a little excuse to go, oh, you just kind of like wave your pro wrestling magic wand. There's certain like cliches accepted and stuff. It's like, all right, we're just gonna do this. When there's no audience there to kind of cover up anything that seems a bit ridiculous, you might as well be doing MMA if you want to make it appealing.
Yeah.
And you can't do MMA.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's more like a dance than it is MMA. I like, from my perspective, it looks like that. I mean, just a very rough dance.
It's a dance that really hurts. That's it. As much as, you know, there's people that like to, I think anybody who even briefly taps into the wrestling bubble will realize that wrestling fans and wrestlers kind of resent it being called fake.
Right.
Even if we say it ourselves to make but if you're not in our group, you don't have the right to like say that kind of word. It's so strong. Because the pain is real. The physicality is real. But obviously the outcome is predetermined. That's pretty much it.
But if you get smacked on the chest or slammed to the mat, I mean, that's really happening. I mean, ain't no faking that.
There's no way to fake that. I can tell you, I've had barbecue skewers stabbed in my head.
Ah.
I've had salt poured in my wounds. That I've taken razor blades and cut myself for the show. There, I've fallen through barbed wire. I've
it's fake.
There's people that have done way crazier shit than I have, just look up Janela and all the, like, some of that. Or look up like June Kasai, who's like one of the best deathmatch wrestlers ever. Like, look up that stuff. Jimmy Havoc, who you can see on AEW now. Mm-hmm. But it is so dependent on the audience from both a spectator standpoint and from a wrestler standpoint, and just the TV product itself. It's missing something without it.
Yeah, one of to sort of like keep on this point, like one of the most like realist things I'd ever seen in my entire life, which had real life consequences on one of the people in it, was the match between it was a New Japan match Katsuyori Shibata.
Okada and Shibata.
Oh my God, Shibata, when he just did that sick headbutt and like blood just starts rolling down the side of his face. He's not wrestled since because he had a hemorrhage in his brain, you know?
Yeah. That's like Shibata is so, at this point, almost like immortalized. He had such a great story in New Japan, and then it was kind of culminated with that match with Okada.
Yeah.
Who Okada, I think, just pound for pound, if you look at the matches he's had, he's
great. He's so good.
Probably the best. He's so amazing. And Shibata was nothing short of just that amazing. And yeah, it was the last match Shibata ever wrestled because he gave a shoot headbutt to Okada, and it's the craziest, coolest image I think I can really point to in pro wrestling of him giving Okada the headbutt.
So
Shibata,
sick.
And then Okada collapsing down, described that trickle of blood coming down Shibata's face, and him just kind of looking up at the audience, and I'm like, oh my God, I love Shibata now. And then ended his career.
Yeah. And
it's very real. Yeah. The injury and the physicality is very real.
But yeah, that guy is just like, I don't know, he was just like amazing. My first ever exposure to him was when I saw him with a match with Tomohiro Ishii like three or four years ago, and they just would just take turns just kicking the shit out of one another and like punching each other in the head and in the back.
I've had the pleasure of wrestling Ishii.
Yeah. I love him too. I love
like,
that guy.
I've wrestled three, he's so good. I've wrestled him three different times, three times. And he's so tough.
Mm-hmm.
So like at one point we had a match in New York, and it was so humbling because obviously he's my senior and he's like, he's an established person who's well respected. And I went up to him and it's before the match and stuff. And I was like, okay, so is there anything you want to do? And he just goes, oh, you call.
Nice.
I was like,
oh, that's cool.
What did you just ask? He gave me, and the match in New York was quite good too. So I was really happy about that. So cool. At one point in the match, he goes, headbutt. Then I was like, oh, okay. So I was ready to take a headbutt from him, but he goes, no, you headbutt. And I was like, all right. So he literally asked me to give him a headbutt, and I gave it to him. And I thought it was a little too there.
Yeah.
And I gave this look. I'm thinking like, fuck, he's gonna destroy me now. And he just like,
got you back.
I was, oh, fuck. But yeah, he's. But Ishii hits quite hard.
Yeah.
He's just what a professional. He's such a professional.
Yeah. And
all that. I mean, just mentioning here, I don't know how many listeners know about New Japan Pro Wrestling.
Yeah.
But New Japan Pro Wrestling is just, especially over the past like 5-6 years, especially over that, has
so
been
good.
Taken everything to another level. Yeah.
So good. And and just to kind of like operate on who this who Tomohiro Ishii is, he's like a veteran for what, like something like 15-20 years, and you know, he's one of the toughest looking guys and toughest guys I've ever seen. He kind of looks like a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle that just kind of grew up, doesn't he?
His nickname is the Stone Pit.
Yeah, the Stone. Oh yeah, his shirt is so cool too.
It fits. I mean, the description is it fits. Mm-hmm. You know, it that that's what he is. Mm-hmm. He looks like a little pit. He looks like a little pit bull, and he hits like one. He is, he's tough, man. He's great. Mm-hmm. He's such a good wrestler. Mm-hmm. There was a match from a Rev Pro with him and Chris Hero from 2016.
Oh, yeah.
I forget. And yo,
shout out to him. Just lost his job, man. But go ahead.
Yeah. It's so good. And yeah, shout out to Chris Hero as far as being probably the possibly arguably the best independent pro wrestler in ring, like pound for pound.
Yeah.
Just as a pure in ring talent.
And a teacher. Chris Hero and a
is
teacher
up there,
too.
Arguably the best ever.
He's got a reputation as being a good teacher as well, like showing people how to go through it. I mean, he was hired on at WWE as a trainer, from what I understand.
Well, he was hired as a talent, but they would send him out like when WWE kind of got a little bit looser with its restrictions on a talent, like when they would kind of let a lot more of its signed talent go do indie shows. Yeah. Hero was always the guy they would send out because he's such a good evaluator of talent, and he's a great trainer and all of that.
Anyway, yeah, man, wrestling is good. WWE like is the sort of like the Hydra at this point or whatever, and you know, it's not like I'm not trying to like make the argument that like WWE needs to like end or whatever, but there definitely needs to be justice for the workers, and there definitely needs to be better conditions, and period, and the people that are standing in front of that are the bosses. I mean, just like always. I mean, we need to see. I don't know. You might disagree with that. I mean, I want there to be more independent wrestling, and I want there to be like the standard, as we keep putting it, to have to sort of make things a lot more. There's a lot for there to be more justice for the workers. You know,
100%. I mean, from a corporate wrestling level, yeah, the inequities are quite obvious. I mean, you have pro athletes. These are professional athletes, or if you want to call them actors, cool, that's fine too. Either way, at this very high standard, this very high level in which there's hundreds of millions of dollars being poured into these individual companies from TV deals and things like that, the people that are producing the content don't get pension. They don't get health insurance. Like we talked about before, they don't get their travel covered. They don't get their accommodation covered. They're called independent contractors when they're actually employees, just so that the company can put off paying a certain payroll tax. Like it is, it exists on a this power imbalance exists on a corporate wrestling level to the nth degree. And then on an independent wrestling level, it's sort of the same. It's a little bit more balanced because when you look at the revenue splits, generally speaking, more of the money that's generated from independent wrestling goes towards paying the talent. There's a bunch of indie wrestlers, at least before this crisis, that were able to live full time on indie wrestling because there was a bit of an indie wrestling boom globally. And I mean, we'll see what happens now with all of this. But like, there are still things like there's so many shows that I would go to on independent wrestling level where we wouldn't be provided with water or even like food. Or sometimes a lot of times people are paying out of pocket to wrestle for these places, or they're going there getting paid peanuts because these promoters are saying that exposure is worth your.
That's like
your travel is worth the lifeline.
Yeah, that's like the Huffington Post used to do for writers. I don't know if you remember that, but that was one of the things that they would do. Is that they would be like, oh, we'll put you on our front page, and we won't pay you, of course, but you'll get the exposure, and then you'll get paid. And that sort of became the industry standard for a while.
Yo, if only exposure could fill my gas tank.
Yeah,
like that'd be great.
Yeah, I'm hungry. I'm gonna eat some exposure.
But yeah, these things exist, which is. Has always been a problem, and wrestlers talk about it to each other all the time because, in case you don't know, wrestlers love to complain about their bosses, and wrestlers love to complain about wrestling. So we've all known about this, which is kind of what pushed myself and my business partner, world-renowned portrait photographer James Musselwhite, to start We the Independent, where we basically Well, not basically. We do. We started a merchandising company that takes portion of its proceeds to sponsor wrestlers' trade union membership into mm-hmm. equity. Right now, we're focused in the UK, and we've gotten multiple companies to agree to the code of conduct or standard of practice, whichever you prefer to mm-hmm. call it. And through that adoption of a code of conduct comes recognition of its of a union of its roster.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of stuff we were doing before that, and we did a lot of work with Equity. Like, we pushed Equity to have its insurers include pro wrestlers in their disability welfare policy for the first time ever. Even through this crisis right now, now Equity is offering up to a 400-pound grant through for union members who have lost out on their work.
Oh, wow.
It's pretty crazy, the things that didn't exist that now exist just through kind of prodding and yeah. poking at the system, you know, because they obviously
organizing.
That's what it comes down to. So before all of this happened, we were making some good progress, and there is still some, you know, we're obviously still trying to do what we can in the meantime. There was a lot of problems that existed in pro wrestling, and little things that we've been trying to do, it's been working so far. I mean, just through our campaign, we've more than quadrupled the number of wrestlers that have joined Equity.
Great.
We had more companies provide food and water for those wrestlers, providing transportation and being more transparent about accommodation and things like that. We've had companies that were literally doing the same. We were just talking about, like, oh, you can work for free, but we're going to give you exposure. We've called those companies out and actually, through public discourse, forced them to start paying mm-hmm. their workers full time. A lot of stuff that's happened over the past year and a half year. And it just comes through pointing out the ridiculous power imbalance that exists.
Yeah, that's really interesting too, because I know that WWE has set its sights on the UK in the past couple of years, like, which I imagine is happening. I mean, I can't imagine time there being two different timelines, so it's happening concurrent to you doing this kind of work. Has that kind of focus, or at least sort of, you know, entrance into that arena by the WWE affect the work that you're doing?
Well, there are multiple companies that are on the European scene that are considered WWE affiliates,
uh-huh.
or basically they've signed contracts in which WWE kind of owns them.
Right.
And for those companies, I'm not allowed to work there anymore.
Right.
And for a lot of those companies, or it's not that I'm not allowed to work there, but I'm not allowed to be put over, which means I'm not.
You're going to lose.
I'm not allowed to be put in a prominent position at these places. So that exists, and that's basically just because of the things that I've been saying.
Yeah.
Not even being critical of WWE, because I've been critical of WWE a while, but it came through my actual push mm-hmm. to organize.
That's what really scares them.
Well, it is what it is. You know, it's just kind of got to roll the punches. Freedom of speech is not freedom from consequence. And I do understand that we live in this ridiculous society in which these kind of union busting actions are, I guess, just kind of accepted. So I don't really have the resources to, like, sue, and that's not really what I'm going to do. I have plenty of outlets right now, and I still have the ability to speak out and do that. And if anything, it's kind of like the Streisand effect. So I'm pretty okay with it. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to the UK, like, the UK had a huge booming independent wrestling scene, and to the point where actually they relaunched a product called World of Sport on ITV, which is a huge, huge
classic. So cool.
ITV is a huge television station in the UK. It's the number two behind all the BBC is ITV. And they relaunched World of Sport, and for one season. And after that happened, WWE freaked out so much that they decided to launch a UK brand.
Yeah.
And they've kind of neglected this UK brand, and it's been I mean, and the talent they picked, like the best talent that's out there. They're so good. But for whatever reason, the shows themselves haven't really clicked. But they bought up a bunch of the talent that was on the indies, a bunch of the talent they were headlining all of these huge shows that created this massive European wrestling boom. WWE just threw a bunch of money at them.
Yeah.
And just so it just so happens that a lot of these people that they picked up first and foremost were people that started organizing with Equity back in like 2015, 2016.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. So there was like this little inside baseball here. There was like a behind the scenes, like behind the curtain kind of push to get as many wrestlers to sign up to Equity, because Equity decided to let freelance pro wrestlers into their union for whatever reason. Actually, the reason was because Stephen Duncan Rice, who is the Southeast regional organizer, is a huge wrestling fan, and he pushed Equity to let pro wrestlers into the union.
And let's be honest too, let's be honest too. I mean, if a union's getting more members, helps the union. Period. The end. I mean,
that's right, man. And more, it strengthens the union. So back in 2015, 2016 time, there was a behind the curtain push to have independent wrestlers in the UK join Equity. And then it just so happens that WWE came in and bought off all those guys who were doing it. I mean, I don't know if it's directly related.
Yeah.
It might just be crazy coincidence, but that's what happened. I mean,
they brought in sick talent too, guys like Trent Seven and Pete Dunne and Tyler Bate. Yeah. Oh my God. Those guys can go.
They're amazing.
If you've seen any of the I'm not so familiar with the UK scene, but I've seen some of the WWE matches between Tyler Bate and Pete Dunne, and oh my God, are they good. Like so great.
Those two as in-ring talent between Tyler Bate and Pete Dunne, they, depending on how long they wrestle for, whatever, which I, as far as I would imagine, they would go, let's just say they wrestle for another, like,
they're so
15
young.
Years.
They're like so your age. They're
young.
Like your age, huh? No. Tyler's younger. Tyler is like 97. Like, 1997 or something like that he was born.
I roomed with Tyler. I lived in Germany with Tyler for a total of, I don't know, like 3 months, 4 months. I'm quite close to Tyler, and he's stupid young. I think he's like 23, 24.
Yeah.
Pete is like 25, I think, maybe 26, maybe.
Yeah.
Those guys are just like unbelievable, like once in a generation talent.
Yeah.
Like on the UK scene, they're like Larry Bird and Magic Johnson. Like it is, it's insane. Or you could say the same thing about the opposite of that, like kind of just before them, which still very young, is like Marty Scurll and Will Ospreay. Kind of like the Bird and Johnson sort of thing. The talent that came up through the UK scene. I mean, there's how and why the UK scene like rebuilt itself with all of these homegrown talents. It's insane to think about the talent that's in this tiny little island.
Yeah.
And WWE just bought up all of them.
Snapped them up like nothing.
Yeah. Like nothing.
Yeah, that's wild. That is wild. Tell us a little bit more. So how can we get more information about We the Independent? And also, I don't want to lie. Like, I guess I'm interested in what this kind of work would look like stateside. So maybe talk about We the Independent and then kind of move on.
Sure. We the Independent, if you want to get more information, you can check out like all of our social media, which our Twitter is probably our most active thing. Which is at We the Indie, spelled with an IE, not a Y, because we're indie, not indie. Or you can check out our website, wetheindependent.com. And through there, you'll see like an About Us. You'll see our merchandise shop. You'll see links to our podcast, where we're a labor relations podcast within pro wrestling. We talk about politics in the UK and the US, and we talk about pro wrestling things. And we have interviews with the most diverse group of guests I think any podcast has.
Uh-huh.
It's pretty awesome. And we talk about, we don't shy away from any topic or shy away from any target. So it's a quite good, I feel really good about our podcast, to be honest with you. We've been doing pretty well. So, but yeah, if you want to get more information about us, go to our website, wetheindependent.com, and that has kind of an about us and a little bit of our history, and listen to our podcast too. And you can check out, you'll learn about our company through that.
Eddie Kingston on too. I mean, he's like, I'm a big fan of his.
Eddie's my man. Eddie's one of my, one of my good friends in this industry. And he's an experience both from a wrestling standpoint and from like a real life standpoint. He's been through some stuff.
Uh-huh.
We're talking about a Comrades podcast here. So
yeah, Good Morning Comrade.
Some good leftist stuff that happens. We talked to Shane Taylor as well, who's lives in Texas. He's from Cleveland. He wrestles for Ring of Honor.
Nice.
We don't shy away from topics, man. We had, if you go back and you can listen to our one of our podcasts from early December, where we break down the general election that happened in the UK.
Heartbreaker.
With Mark Leslie, who, uh-huh. and we do some good stuff. We're really happy with everything we've been able to produce. As far as our reach in the U.S., we actually have been speaking to a bunch of different trade unions in the U.S. that we're trying to, I guess, work with to utilize their infrastructure that they've created to help freelance pro wrestlers.
That's the way to do it.
We've talked to a few different unions, and every single time we've had a sit down meeting with them, they end up being like, okay, cool, we'll let in freelance pro wrestlers into their union. But there are some issues that it comes with the benefits that, and the reality of what independent pro wrestling is in America.
Mm-hmm.
So we're still kind of on the prowl looking for a union we can kind of partner with in the US. There are some connections, obviously, with our UK relationship with Equity, where Equity has other branches in other countries.
Cool.
We're exploring a bunch of different options, but overall, I think we're in it for the long run. You know, the thing I've kind of been telling myself is you got to walk before you run. Or even before that, you got to crawl before you walk, got to walk before you run. But at some point, we're going to get to a full sprint.
Yeah. That's a great way to put it. That's a great way to put it. And like, yeah, organizing is a process more than it is anything. It's not just like one day, bing, bang, boom, everybody's got the class consciousness, right? It doesn't work like that. It's just, you have to learn through doing. You know, you could talk about your, you know, theory, and that's all important, extremely important. But I mean, like, if you don't like go through it and experience it, it's not real, you know?
I think one of the other things that has become a bit of an issue, and this isn't just within wrestling, this is just overall with organizing, mm-hmm. is that I think there's a lot more people in today's day and age, because of all of this extremism that has come out from our top line politicians.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot more consciousness when it comes to political issues. So mm-hmm. I think there is more of a recognition of what is left and what is right, mm-hmm. and what your identity is. I mm-hmm. think some people are kind of picking, I think a lot of us are kind of picking things like as if it's a sports team.
Yeah.
And I think some people have associated organizing labor with leftism, which I think is, if you want to get into a deep dive on it, you could say, is that a failure of the left by not kind of dismissing its own ideology in favor of like the bigger picture, right? Mm-hmm. Because organizing labor isn't a left issue, isn't a right issue. It is a class issue.
Yeah.
And I think that we've tied in our own political ideology a lot of times, and I'm guilty of it myself. So it's not like this is like an outside criticism. Mm-hmm. To our labor organizing. And I think some of that might turn people off. And I think this, again, like this hyper consciousness that exists within our society at this point of political ideologies, I guess, might be detrimental to labor organizing. Because I think back in, I mean, hell, if you look in America back in the 50s and before that, union, being a part of a union was the thing. Mm-hmm. Like, it was dope as fuck to be a part of a union. Hell, it created a middle class, didn't it? And it wasn't really tied into if you voted red or blue. It was just kind of, I'm a worker. I'm the one who's producing.
Mm-hmm.
Again, like I said before, wrestling is this kind of microcosm of the labor struggle in general.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this idea of gratitude and everything. Hell, I just got in a thing on Facebook. These are two examples. Somebody who basically said to me that they considered themselves a liberal until liberals were really mean to them. Or, well, what they said was liberal.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Lived to them because now they're supporting Joe Biden instead of Bernie.
Uh-huh.
And she this person was like, oh, well, I guess I can't be a liberal now because everyone there is being a dick to me.
Well, like, yeah. That's sort of like a symbolic definition and a very surface value sort of relationship with politics, the red team, blue team sort of thing, like you alluded to before, right? And go ahead, you want to pick that up?
Well, I was just gonna say, like, I actually decided to comment on this particular
status,
and I just said, I was like, it sounds more like you didn't have an actual ideology and you were kind of just looking for a social group.
Uh-huh.
Which it's not an insult. Like, I'm not saying anything like that, but when it comes down to it, there are a lot of people that are reaching out for a connection with people. And if you don't actually have a political ideology, and you might, I mean, hell, if you, there's a bunch of people out there that voted for Obama,
uh-huh,
that thought they were these like sick leftists, right? but they just kind of realized that Obama was the lesser of the evils,
uh-huh,
of the accepted evils that were out there.
Right.
And that's how it is. Like, I mean, hell, I mean, I could say this right now. I mean, obviously, I mean, the biggest indictment of Obama is the legacy he left, which is Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden. I mean,
and over,
those are the,
you know,
people
over what it was like 1,000 seats that were lost across the country in state legislatures. I mean, it's just absolutely ridiculous.
Obama was great for Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like, and you know, I struggle even with what I believe, as far as what Obama was he somebody who had ideas and was just beaten down by the system,
mm-hmm,
or is he somebody that knew espousing these ideas that he had could advance in the system? I don't know which to kind of accept, but I do know that in hindsight, I wish he actually was as close to Reverend Wright as
you're not the first person I've heard said that.
He said he was. but you know, maybe this idea overall, this point that I'm trying to make is that tying political ideology or left and right to labor,
mm-hmm,
maybe that's been detrimental, because I think that with this hyper consciousness of politics at this point, because I think it's kind of necessary almost, mm-hmm, for survival,
I think
it's gotten to that point.
I think tying it to symbolic politics like you're describing is a problem. Now, tying the sort of like labor to specific issues that are pertinent and valuable to those workers, it doesn't sound like that's what you're talking about, but that's the thing that needs to be, like, that's the wagon you need to hitch it to. So you hitch the wagon to, so things like, I mean, I'm a big Bernie guy, you're wearing a Bernie shirt right now, but like the Workplace Democracy Act, right, which would have made things like hard. I talk about I'm like the one guy on radio that talks about the Workplace Democracy Act nonstop. But like,
it was
like,
amazing. Amazing.
Yeah, it was like a wish list for labor unions. And part of the reason, and Bernie couldn't get labor support, and that was part of his undoing. And part of that was, I think that was a lot of focus on that policy from him, and there was less of a focus on that policy from the labor unions, because there is such a relationship with the sort of like actual infrastructure that surrounds these top level politics, you know, national level and even state level.
Well, yeah, I think that was kind of summarized quite well with the Nevada caucus.
Oh yeah.
You know, where you had the Las Vegas Culinary Union coming out basically being anti-Bernie, and then rank and file members are sitting there like, no, we love what Bernie's talking about. What are you talking about? But outside of that, I think that there's obviously been an extreme amount of propaganda, anti-union propaganda, and it comes from things just like I just said with the culinary union, because you see this this union bureaucracy that exists where the leaders of these unions serve. They still serve the rank and file members.
Of course they do.
But they still kind of serve themselves. Like for opposing, you know, union leaders opposing Medicare for All, because one of the big things they get credit for is negotiating their plans for the rank and file members. They want to give up that power that they have, even if it benefits the rank and file members. Right. They're kind of like, oh, well, like our power is this. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's... just talking about the democracy in the workplace.
Yeah, the workplace democracy.
That policy that Bernie it was kind of revolutionary to put these ideas on the table. And Bernie's biggest failure when it comes to, because he lost a lot of like middle class labor support, really came from this embrace of woke politics, which said, I feel like anybody who self-identifies as woke voted for Elizabeth Warren.
That's purely symbolic politics, isn't it? That's purely symbolic.
Yeah.
There's no material relation that goes along with that in a real sense. And it's funny, we have a show that's probably going to come up before this one where we talk about some of this stuff with Matt Chrisman from Chapel Trap House, but we talked because he's been talking about this a lot on some really great vlogs recently. But one of the things that that is a kind of a break from material politics, and it focuses on things that cannot be changed under any circumstances, you know.
I think I saw someone say this
and matter not at all
when they were talking about Bernie's campaign.
Not at all. That's too far. But like, it doesn't not matter at all. But I mean, like, it does have material effects. But like, it does not show a fundamental difference among people. Is what I suppose I mean.
I think that overall, I think that kind of grappling with this idea, like, okay, so James like James Carville sucks, right? Like, he totally. But some things where you can take little snippets of what he says, and when he talks about like the left kind of grabbing power, and this idea that because Republicans are successful want power, and the Democratic Party is not really in that same way, and actually in fact even more so the same way, because Bernie this recent campaign, he hired a lot of people to get this presidency that didn't seem to want to back him in 2016, but then at the same note kind of abandoned the one that did, which you were just talking about. Like, he kind of lost like labor, like a little bit of labor support, even though he is the strongest labor that I think that we've had in the past 30-40 years. Like, he's the most pro-labor congressperson we've ever had, and in the modern era, and kind of embraced this woke politics, and his campaign embraced woke politics as opposed to embracing class warfare. And that's what we were just talking about, which is really, it's all about class war. And because whether you're right or you're left, which is why Bernie's biggest fight was going to be in the primary, not in the general. If Bernie got in the general, I think it would have been a lot easier.
Yeah.
Other than fighting against
the Democrats. The
Democratic.
Yeah.
His biggest fight was with the.
Yeah, with the internal stuff. That's to be expected, I suppose, to some extent. I do want to kind of go back to the like some of the like functional to the functional kind of 226 stuff as well, because I think it's a little bit more like I think it's a little bit deeper. I think you're right about a lot of it in the sense that like there is a sort of a bit of a there's not a perfect one-to-one, you know, leadership and membership sort of like understanding, and you know there's some degree of differentiation in sort of like what individuals in those positions would need. One of the things that I sort of think of as well from like in a leadership perspective, because I try to put myself in those shoes sometimes, and I think like, okay, so if we back this guy, if we back Bernie and he loses, then Joe Biden is probably going to be vindictive. If we back him and he wins and we don't get Medicare for all, that's still better. If we, but specifically, if we get Medicare for all, he wins, we get Medicare for all, we dismantle this entire structure that we have to sort of like have the pensions that exist. And then in 4 years, the Republicans take over and destroy Medicare for all. Our workers are so fucked, you know? Like, I'm just sort of like thinking of a couple different levels of that.
Well, I mean, if we really think about it, so like I understand anybody that was hesitant to vote for Hillary Clinton. Like I don't blame anybody for not voting for Hillary.
And she's way more vindictive than Biden would have been.
She sucks.
Mm-hmm.
Let's put it that way, for not wanting to vote for Hillary Clinton. Okay, but in reality, we would have gotten a little bit more of those breadcrumbs she talked about.
Mm-hmm.
But on the same note, it's like, does that sort of neoliberalism just yield a stronger right?
Mm-hmm.
Because, I have a fishhook theory, mm-hmm, where the center is directly in line with the extreme right,
yeah,
or fascism, significantly more. I mean, I do believe that the Democratic Party would rather lose to fascists than win with socialists.
Right.
I 100% believe that. I think it's based on how hard against someone like Bernie and someone like Ilhan Omar and someone Nosi and Rashida Tlaib and et cetera. I think Ayanna Pressley is a little bit more accepted, but
not by
the
Liz
point
Warren,
is
though.
Like how hard they fight against them. Well, as hard as they fight against them, they don't even come close to fighting that Trump. I mean, they still pass all of his budgets. They don't put up a fight at all. And now I think we get, I mean, we've had a couple of our guys infiltrate the base, right?
Uh-huh.
You have AOC in there. I think I just said the squad in general.
Yeah.
And now they're kind of being like, oh man, we have to work within the system. So you have this like weird inside outside game that exists. And where do we actually stand? Because we need change now.
Uh-huh.
And people that are playing a long game. And if you had, I guess this just does come back to, does someone like, does an administration like Obama that gave us half loaves or breadcrumbs,
uh-huh,
probably closer to,
yeah,
breadcrumbs, that yielded a Donald Trump.
Uh-huh.
And I think that, so we back Bernie because we know that he would fight the hardest.
Uh-huh.
And we know that if we had a Bernie Sanders, we'd have somebody who was in our, than anybody else that has been,
yeah,
in our lifetime, more so than Jimmy Carter, probably the most progressive president since FDR. So I get the question is like, So if you get, so we back Bernie, right?
Uh-huh.
If Bernie wins,
2-6,
then you have to suffer with the consequences of, you would be sick. You also have to suffer with the consequences of, okay, well, now your guys, so you know that we have a short rope to hang ourselves with. Uh-huh. So like, get shit done.
Yeah.
You know, if Bernie didn't get shit done, then it would be a huge, it would be a way to bury the left forever.
Yeah.
If we went with Bernie and Bernie, I think the worst case scenario would have been if Bernie had won the nomination and lost to Trump, because then they would have used it as a way to, even more so, a way to bury the left forever.
Yeah.
I think that we still have to, I mean, I guess there's this big battle on the left as to whether to embrace electoral politics in general or not. And I think we have to kind of know politics is an end, possibly, and it's one way we should fight, but it's not the end all be all.
Yeah. And the idea is like, and this is one of the sort of critiques that I've kind of given, and to varying extents, depending on who I'm talking about, there's, you know, different levels of receptiveness, but like, if you have an organization that's going to do like left politics or whatever, and you want to engage with like working class institutions, or if you're, you know, if you're claiming that you're working class institution, that's good too. But I mean, like I'm talking about established institutions like labor unions. There are components of, let's just say, like a DSA chapter, or there are people in a DSA chapter who are already in those places, right? Starting and providing support and resources for those folks to get engaged and start pushing things along in these places where they already are is sort of like a thing that I've not particularly seen play out so much, and it's something that really would be something that would be great. I mean, that would be one of the best places to start that I can think of.
Well, I mean, I can speak, I mean, from personal experience. I mean, I've been a member of DSA for a while, but I just joined the other night a DSA, my local DSA branch.
Uh-huh.
I just joined one of those calls, and there's so many new people that are on this Zoom call.
Uh-huh.
And this sort of organizing is still happening. It's still happening. If I can, I'll let me read this quote from a really prominent leftist pro wrestler that I'm good friends with, sent me this little this little quote, and it was specifically regarding what's happening right now. Be confident. By the end of the month, there'll only be two kinds of people in British politics: reluctant socialists and enthusiastic ones. And so I think that there are people that are, I guess, in a way, radicalized by this crisis. I think we all kind of have our own roads into whatever we kind of be. Like, we've been talking about political ideology so much in this talk, but I think that's so important to people. And I mean, for me, 2016 is where I realized where I stood. I heard Bernie talk, I heard Hillary talk, and I was like, wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a big difference here.
Yeah, like, one person is inspiring me to believe in what I deserve as in who's producing for our for humanity, or for our society. The other is kind of saying, you don't deserve shit.
Yeah.
And I'm like, all right. Well, yeah. I definitely feel this way.
I like the first one better.
I think we all kind of, we kind of understand ourselves through our experience. And I think there's a lot of people that are going through this right now that are getting radicalized because they understand that this is kind of, is exacerbating all the issues that existed within our society to begin with and within our economy to begin with. Because how many times do we have to be gaslit watching CNN, MSNBC or something like that, being told the economy is good when we can't afford our food, when we can't afford rent, when we can't afford this stuff. So how much could be gaslit by what's supposed to be our liberal news station that things are going great? My boss is screwing me over because I'm only barely getting paid enough to rely on government benefits, which I don't want to do because my boss can actually afford for me to live properly.
Right.
So, I mean, I think that maybe this, hopefully, being optimistic, this crisis does radicalize people in terms of just understanding that we are in a dire situation to balance the power.
There's there's energy and there's a like a lot going on. There's a lot of energy there, and it can go either the way like the way towards justice, or the way towards like the Trumpist fascism. You know, it's literally socialism or barbarism. Now, the question becomes, what do you do to make it go the way that you want it to go? And that's the sort of like, you know, $64 question, you know, to sound like a 64-year-old man.
I mean, I definitely don't think the way to go, like, I would love to be naive and say that one person doesn't kind of define what we're doing.
100%.
But nominating Joe Biden is such a if you had nominated Bernie, and you'd have this person who's, you know, espousing these what you'd consider radical ideas and almost normalizing them, saying them on a regular basis with free media that they have to give him on cable television. If he's the Democratic Party's nominee for president of the United States, they have one. That there's so many more people to understand what's going on, as opposed to Joe Biden, who is just, I mean, I just saw on the Hill, I saw what nationally he's pulling behind Trump now.
Oh boy.
Because he's not inspiring anybody. Because everybody's bored. Because he's the guy to bring everything back to normal.
Yeah.
Basically, the president's going to be so boring, you're not even going to think about it. You're just going to live your life. You know? Like, well, guess what, motherfucker? We don't have time for that shit. And on top of that, now, how does that compete? Like, how are you supposed to sit there, who can barely remember the sentence you started, supposed to compete with somebody who, like, igniting an entire base of people? Like, you're talking about, like, they could either go this way or this way. And that's when, you know, you get in the conversation, the rise of Bernie and the rise of Trump are two complete polar opposite solutions to the same fucking problem.
Yeah.
And
that's literally the choice, socialism or barbarism, right?
As we push it more, we can't settle for breadcrumbs. And it's,
yeah, that's what the third way is. The third way is breadcrumbs.
It really is. If you want breadcrumbs, save America. You know, like, there you go. But it's just like, why is normal the alternative to fascism?
Yeah.
The idea of non-radical politics that empowers the working class. Something, why is it so foreign? Because FDR was he's the most elected president ever, because people recognized they were struggling and we couldn't afford them. So I think that, oh man, it's scary because everybody's gaslit to thinking socialism is a four-letter word.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot, David. Where can we get, you said wetheindependent.com, wetheindy on Twitter, and we can follow you on Twitter as well, at the Project DS?
Yeah, at the
All right.
Yep, at the podcast.com, and you can go to my other my social media store to see all my other merchandise stores and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Check out our guest, the wetheindependent.com/ all that stuff. Get a bunch of good stuff on there. So please check it out. Thank you guys so much.
Cool, man. And you can listen to Good Morning Comrade every Tuesday on WHIV. We have Tuesday shows. We have Thursday shows. You can get more information, goodmorningcomrade.com. Listen on 102.3 FM. We're going to have you back sometime. If we ever get to see people face to face, I'd love to kind of meet up if you're ever in town.
Yeah, of course, man. That'd be great. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Cool. Well, thanks, everybody. We'll love you. Bye.